You're listening to the Friends Talking Podcast. I'm Joel Greenberg, and this is
Martha Rogers. I'm a founding partner of Peppers and Rogers Group. It's a division of Carlson Marketing Worldwide.
I had the pleasure of sitting down with Martha Rogers to talk about her thoughts on marketing. Dr. Rogers, with her business partner Don Peppers, popularized the notion of one-to-one marketing in books such as The One-to-One Future, Enterprise One-to-One, The One-to-One Manager. You get the picture. It's this idea that technology efficiently allows us to know a lot about each of our customers as individuals. And then we tailor our brand's experience to each one of our individual customers instead of treating all of them as one demographic, say, as they do in TV. In their new book, Return on Customer, they popularize the notion that in addition to ROI, that's return on investment, companies should evaluate marketing efforts in terms of ROC, or return on customer. In other words, the lifetime value of the customer to the corporation. Short-term ROI doesn't always coincide with long-term ROC, and you need both measures to truly understand how to grow a company. As Dr. Rogers says, customers are the scarcest commodity, scarcer than capital even. So this has a number of interesting implications. First, for large brands, the marketing focus for some is moving away from mass media and going towards customized experiences. Where does the money come from? How about that boatload of cash companies are spending for TV advertising? While in the 20th century, TV was the greatest sales tool ever developed, increased clutter has diminished its effectiveness, driving more companies to one-to-one, and in the future, they'll probably fund more and more of the new efforts with money from TV. Don't believe me? When's the last time you saw a TV commercial for Starbucks? Second, for small companies, a one-to-one approach could mean the difference between life and death. Walmart doesn't know about their individual customers yet, but a niche player could. In reality, we're in a paradigm shift in marketing, in very much the way described by Thomas Kuhn, who popularized the term in his book, The Study of Scientific Revolutions. Some marketers understand the value of what Rogers brings, but some don't. Nor can they, because they have internalized the paradigm of 20th century marketing so much, it's hard to think of something new. So decide for yourself. Here's what she says. So how do you explain what you do to your parents and your parents' friends?
That's a great question. Well, it depends on my mood, I guess. I tell them that I write business books, and then I go around talking about it, and sometimes I get to help companies put those ideas into play. So I guess that's probably what I say.
Do they buy it?
Sometimes. Mostly we just get another glass of wine at that point.
And so, in a nutshell, what is return on customer?
Very good question. It's basically the rate at which customers create value for a company in the short run and the long run. So are we deliberately creating customer value? Are we deliberately harvesting that value? Or some companies are even destroying that value. But what is the rate at which the customer's lifetime value and customer equity are being increased or decreased?
And you had mentioned before that ad agencies are kind of, I don't know if resistant is the right word, but it's different DNA than what we're talking about.
It is different DNA, and it feels strange to me that it is, because I actually, in another life a long time ago, about a million years ago, I wrote ad copy and worked for ad agencies. And Don was on Madison Avenue when I met him, Don Peppers. And so we feel like we are sort of agency people, but I realized that I haven't really walked inside of an ad agency in years, because what we do now is kind of sort of diverted from what agencies are doing. And it suddenly dawns on me that that's kind of a weird thing, because ad agencies, since the beginning of the 20th century, have been in the business of finding customers for products and helping companies, you know, build brands to give an impression to customers about things. And suddenly we find ourselves in a different part of the world from that, if we're trying to build customer value and build shareholder value by building better relationships with customers. Those are two different things now. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Why not?
Because it seems to me as though the relationships that we build with customers are dependent on every single way that we touch the customer. And some of those ways are under our control and some are not. But every single way that is under our control, we need to be able to coordinate in such a way that we're always enhancing the value of a customer, and in that way, increasing shareholder value, even if the shareholders only sit around the kitchen table, but increasing shareholder value for the sponsor company.
Now, that assumes that you've got a customer and you've got and you want to develop a relationship with them.
Right.
A lot of times we're finding new customers. Is that one of the reasons why?
Maybe. Maybe it's acquisition versus retention. But the thing of it is that good CRM, and by the way, I'm not really fond of the term CRM. I think that the folks in the technology world sort of usurped it. But when we think about building relationships with customers, developing this kind of one-to-one approach, basically what we're looking at is figuring out how to think of customers as the quintessential value maker for the company. They're the only source of revenue that we have. And no matter how scarce products are, or no matter how scarce capital is, no matter how scarce distribution channels or any, the scarcest thing that's out there is a customer. So when we're trying to keep customers or whether we're trying to get customers, it's really all the same thing. I need to know today what the value of a customer is today, but I also need to know today what the value of a customer is tomorrow. And I need to know today what the value of a customer is that I don't even have yet. So in my mind, there's not as much difference between the idea of acquisition and retention as maybe there was back in the old days, way back in the 1900s.
Are you seeing more people going towards this relationship?
More companies?
Yeah, more companies going more towards the relationship and maybe taking money out of their mass advertising?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, thank heavens for me, because that's the business we're in. But they're basically, I think that what they have realized is that I need to be able to know which customers I have. I need to be able to identify them. I need to be able to know who they are. I need to be able to know what they do. I need to be able to then to tell them apart from other customers, which are more valuable than others. Where should I be putting my resources? I need to know who has different needs, because if I don't meet their different needs, then my competitors might be able to do a better job than I can. The only way I'm going to do that is to interact with customers. So instead of just generating messages, I'm going to be generating, you know, feedback. And then I'm going to be thinking about how to do something for a customer my competitor doesn't know how to do based on what I know. And that being the case, then I'm gonna customize, probably mass customize, but I'm gonna do something with that customer that he can't get anywhere else. To the extent that I'm successful at that, then I'm going to be able to do something for a customer based on something I know that nobody else knows. I'm going to be able to do something that nobody else knows how to do. And that's truly a competitive advantage in a commoditized world.
Looking out over, next 20, 30, 40 years, do
sure.
you see...
No problem.
Well, do you see an end to mass advertising as a result
no,
of our time?
No, I don't. You know, we left the agricultural era and we entered the industrial age, but we didn't stop eating. It's just that agriculture stopped being the center of the economic universe. So, and by the way, the industrial age was caused by technology. It wasn't that somebody, you know, wrote a book or had a great idea or something. It was caused by the fact that we had assembly line technology and electricity and phones and mass media and mass distribution all appear right about the same time. And so, voila, you have, whether you want it or not, you have an industrial age. And therefore, you have the same thing the same way for everybody and the same messages the same way for everybody. That's when brands were born. Well, so the technology changes that we've been going through in the last 10 years have really mandated this sort of customer relationship approach if you want to be successful. It's not that somebody wrote a book or had a great idea. It was really this technology that drove it. So it doesn't mean that we're going to stop advertising or eating. It does mean that the drivers of the success of business are really going to be more about what it will take to keep growing the value of particular customers, growing your company by deliberately growing customer value, growing the value of the only, you know, the scarcest resource you have and the only source of revenue. And therefore, we're going to see a lot more of focus on that rather than just on producing products. Now we produce products as a way of having something to offer customers and increase their value, rather than having products and then going out and finding customers to buy those products as a reason, raison d'etre to exist. So think about it this way. If you, no matter how great your products are, if you didn't have any customers, you wouldn't have a business. You'd just have a hobby. customers.
Do you see a generational difference in marketers who get it? Like the younger people who grew up with Amazon.com, for example?
You know, no, I don't. That's very interesting. I hadn't even thought about that before. But I actually see that the generation above that probably gets it at least as well, if not better, I think partly because of just business experience and having seen a whole bunch of stuff and watching things swing both ways and having survived the recession and actually the last two recessions and all that. But also because I think that there is still being taught in a lot of business schools and communication schools that there's still that job that Tom Hanks had in Nothing in Common.
What was the job?
That was the ad agency job where they pitch it and they do the old-fashioned pitches and it's the romantic view of what ad agency business never really quite was, but you know, and I think there are still kids who want that job. And so although they're very Amazon oriented, they understand Game Boys and they were on computers and the internet and all that stuff, they IM each other, they still think of they have a sort of romance attached to whatever advertising is, and they want that, and I think they're reluctant to give that idea up. Whereas I think the generational difference, yeah, there are a lot of dinosaurs, but, you know, who can bother with them? I don't have time for them. But there are a lot of, I think the people who are really leading this are probably above 40.
So what is the common thing among the people who understand this versus the ones that don't?
They're brilliant. That's all. No, I'm just kidding. I think that they understand that we're living through a major technology upheaval, and that will mandate a different business model, and they're not afraid of what that means for them. I think that the people who are the most resistant to them are really afraid of what it means for them personally. What does that do to my job, my office, my status, my authority, my ideas, my whatever, my next job, my whatever? And I think that the people who really can embrace, you know, the next generation of thinking and understand that advertising and marketing can be quantifiable, that CMOs now exist and can speak CFO language and vice versa, and that accountants can now review books written by marketers. It's, you know, what a concept. That this stuff can actually happen. I think that really comes from a willingness to embrace this kind of change, which is tough. It's hard to embrace change. It's just tough.
So it's been about 13 years since you wrote The 1-1 Future.
It is. That's exactly on the nose.
So what did you think was going to happen in 10 years, and how is that different from what actually happened?
We actually put out a little booklet at the 10-year mark that was, you know, answered that question, you know, what did we predict and what came true and what didn't, which we thought showed incredible integrity on our part to actually admit the things that didn't come true. But so it turned out we were pretty close on a couple of things. In 1993, that first book didn't talk about the internet, because we thought that the first wave of addressable interactivity was going to be more about the fax machine, which now I look at as ridiculous. But we didn't. We saw it coming. There was already a kind of email happening on campuses, and I was a professor then. But when Don and I were writing our first book, we literally put floppy disks into the hard drives of each of our computers and then pulled them out. And I ran over to the Tontogany post office every afternoon and put it in overnight mail and mailed it to him and vice versa. And then and that's how we collaborated on the first book. So the technology came faster than we anticipated. By 1997, though, 4 years later, we were not in what if and that mode. We updated the first book so it reflected the World Wide Web, and we wrote a new book that was all about companies that were actually doing this. So 4 years saw a big change. I guess that probably the thing that we were wrongest about was that we predicted that there would be a huge success in home delivery of especially basics, groceries and things like that. And the only place that there has been a success is with Tesco in the UK. No U.S. business has been able to make money on it. So we were you know, we missed that one. And but stay tuned. We're not giving up on that yet. We also think automatic replenishment is bigger than it has come to pass, and will be bigger in the future. And in fact, has become pretty big for business to business. We turned out to be right, though, I think, about most fundamental things. The I guess it sounds real self-congratulatory, and I apologize for that.
But it's just basically
that the idea that learning relationships are a way to decommoditize. That if I can learn something from you and I can give you back what you want, and my competitor cannot do that, then I can actually charge you more. Instead of buying your loyalty, I actually sell it to you. And those are the most successful kinds of relationships, where there's real trust and where there's real belief that, and where does trust happen? Trust happens when customers believe that you're looking out for my best interest and not just your own. I expect you to look out for your own best interest, but I expect you to look out for mine too. And if I don't have to feel like I'm having to watch over your shoulder all the time, then that gives me a better feeling about the recommendations you make, whether you're my realtor or my insurance agent or my pharmacist or my doctor or any other business that I have to deal with. So that piece, I think, we've sort of got right and we're able to build on. But
what do you see trends over the next 10 or 20 years, one or two trends?
Very good question. We think that probably the biggest things are going to be that we will see a finer and finer breakdown of the way that people get their information and communication. And so, therefore, you know, I'm old enough to remember the day that Kennedy was shot, and I remember that you could change the channel, but you couldn't change the show. So you could change the camera angle, but there was one show on every channel for 4 or 5 days. But now, you know, you don't even have to hear about the Iraqi war if you don't want to. You don't have to know what's going on with Hezbollah. You can just miss all that altogether. And that's before we're all on satellite radio. And that's just the beginning. So I think this sort of splintering of the society is going to be very important. And businesses understanding what that means to them is going to be very important as well. So, and by the way, what does it mean? Well, different things to different business, but I think understanding what how we find the people that we're talking to in a world in which the only mass media anymore are going to be the very few things that are left that can actually charge more than they used to because of the last things that we all watch at the same time. The World Cup. For soccer, the big league baseball and the World Series and the football and the
live events,
right? The Emmys and the you know all that stuff. So otherwise, though, I think it's going to be harder and harder for us to figure out how to reach the right customers at the right place and time. I think that life is going to become hard, has already become harder for the networks. For big radio, it's already gone. And magazines are struggling in ways that they didn't before, unless it's AARP. So I think that we are going to see a continuation of that kind of splintering. And a company that doesn't understand that means not only finding customers, but meeting their and anticipating their needs individually is probably going to be critical as well. And then we believe that it's important to do that in a really quantified way that isn't just a matter of making the message as strong as it can be, but in fact really makes it possible for us to have a quantifiable financial measure that helps a company understand what contribution to its bottom line, to its shareholder value, that this customer brings, and this one, and this one.
Let's go back to this mass question. One of my clients, when I explained a similar thing about the splintering, he said, wait a second, that means everyone's not watching Friends and not talking about in the water cooler. As a society, that's bad. How do we develop shared values? What would your answer be to that?
Yeah, you know what? I think that's a very good point. I mean, there are now people who are signing up for HBO so that we can all at least know what Deadwood is. What does that say? Because what percentage of people even have HBO? A lot of people still don't have access. So it's really, I think that that's right. I think that what that means is that we do have the danger of only listening to ourselves and other people who are just like us and other people who only share our values, and then convincing ourselves because of that that there are only people like us in the world, and then occasionally venturing out to other people. I already believe that there are only people who believe in one-to-one. Every now and then I get out in the real world and find out that there are people who, you know, who don't get it. I'm shocked. I can't believe it. But I do think that we are in danger of creating a world in which we don't understand what it's like for everybody else. So maybe one of the roles of business, of government, of educational institutions is to deliberately help us to understand that.
You're listening to the Friends Talking Podcast. More with Dr. Martha Rogers after this short break. Welcome back. In case you just joined us, I'm talking with Dr. Martha Rogers, founding partner of the Peppers and Rogers Group and author of the new book, Return on Customer, Creating Maximum Value from Your Scarcest Resource.
So what are some business books that you've been reading?
Oh, well, you know, I depend on Amazon to let me know about all the books that are coming out that I have to read. So I actually have to be careful not to buy any business books except from Amazon, because that way they know exactly what I own and they know exactly what I need. I really depend on their suggestions. And fortunately, Don and I are in a position where we get to hear about a lot of books. You know, people who ask us to either write the foreword or review it or do something. So there are always a little pile of manuscripts actually at the house or the office. And so we get to see a lot of things even before they come out.
So what stands out from the crowd?
I think anything by Fred Reichheld is great. The stuff by Paul Greenspan is great. Everything that we've seen from Malcolm Gladwell is ideal. So I think there's really a lot to be learned from the writers who are trying to help us understand how to take what we know about customers and turn that into shareholder value. And that's happening more and more in academia. We have the Duke Center for Customer Relationship Management. We've had that going for 6 years. And we're funding a lot of research. And we actually had part of the Journal of Marketing last fall. And so we're seeing a lot more academic investigation and activity in this area. So we're actually seeing some pretty good stuff coming out of some of the academicians and out of some of the different schools. And that's very exciting, because it takes a long time for these things to crack open into academia. But once it does, then some very interesting things start happening. And we start seeing some PhD stuff work being done. Well, that means that those students are going to spend their careers writing about this. And so that's thrilling to us. We actually wrote a textbook, something I never want to do again in my life, 1,200-page manuscript that I know will sell, at least one-tenth as many copies as any of our other books. But we had to do it because we didn't want somebody else to do it and not say the right stuff. But we also needed it because there hasn't been a textbook. And many schools won't let the course in until there's a textbook on it.
And in fact, you had trouble teaching at one point.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting, because I was teaching at a school where I had met Don. We were starting to work on this. We wanted to teach it, and they had no interest at all in hearing about this one-to-one stuff. And in fact, it was fine if I wanted to publish a book or an article on this subject, but if I was going to get a promotion — I already had tenure — but if I wanted to get a promotion, then I was going to have to write about that regular marketing stuff and in the regular marketing journals. Thanks very much.
So what happened?
I moved departments, and eventually, of course, ended up at Duke instead. So I'm on the faculty there, and I got to tell, I have to say this, terrific school. Anybody thinking about MBA definitely should think about Duke. It's really a great, great faculty. I'm not there very much. I wish I could be there a lot more. But the people who are there all the time are just terrific, including the students.
What should we learn from MySpace?
Oh, very good question. I think that, first of all, that kids are fearless about the amount of information they're willing to give out. They're not like us. They don't realize, first of all, they've never had anything stolen yet. You know, they've never had their locker broken into yet. They don't know what that sense of loss is like yet. So the minute that they actually get something stolen from them, then they'll get more cautious and they'll turn into an adult and be boring. So that's part of it, is that they're fearless about that, just as they're fearless about dying. You know, when I learn to play a video game, I want to not die. The concept is so terrible. But, you know, they die, they start over, that game's over, start another one. And so what MySpace has done is it's brought together a lot of people who are really unafraid of anything technological or of meeting each other. They're not scared of that space. They understand what that space is a lot better than any of us do, because we learned it as a second language. So it's wallpapered over our understanding of what life was like, you know, back in the 1900s. And for them, it's part of life. My own son, the hardest part about getting on a computer for him when he was 16 months old was climbing up in the chair. The rest of it was, you know, easy. And so he and many others have grown up on exactly this kind of stuff. And they, you know, fearless. They're just fearless.
So I hear you have a real killer recipe for cheese popcorn. Could you share that?
Who in the world told you that? We have all kinds of recipes for all kinds of popcorn, because we're big popcorn fans. But we have all kinds of ways to do it. So, yeah, we love popcorn at the Rogers Birch household.
Recipe? You want to share it, or is this a family?
Well, you take regular popcorn and you use the Kabila's thing that stirs it as you bake it. You don't want to. This is not about microwaving. This is the real deal. And then when you're done, you put Parmesan and a little tiny bit of what's the green stuff? What's the green stuff? You must know what this is if you know it.
Parsley.
Yeah, you put dried parsley, a little bit of, but mostly for color, and then you go from there. It's pretty good stuff. You get pretty addicted.
For companies that are thinking, hey, we need to do more of this.
Yeah.
How should they start?
Well, first, of course, they should hire you and us. But in addition to that, what they have to do is they have to simultaneously think about what they know about customers, what else they need to find out about customers. They need to look at their culture and make sure that they really are customer-centric and not just product-centric. They need to think about not just the return on investment they're getting on the products that they make, or not just the profitability of the products, but they need to think about the profitability of their customers and whether or not they can even calculate that, and whether or not they're rewarding people to do that. They need to think about whether they've got the technology in place to make that happen, and whether or not they've got the capability internally of putting the processes into place that make that work. So it's really about people and process and technology and culture, at least as much as it is about strategy and having these this understanding that if they don't create value from customers, they don't have any place else to create value, and there's no place else that shareholders are really going to want to be with them sooner or later.
Well, Dr. Rogers, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joel. It's really been great. Thank you.
So what does all this mean? For one, it's a way for companies to compete. Information on individual customers can potentially level the playing field between large and small companies, domestic and foreign ones. It also means we as consumers will give permission to those brands we like so they know more about us. It's more than just a loyalty program, because knowing about each customer could be the core of a business rather than an addition to it. For example, a shoe company that makes custom shoes needs to know your shoe size in order to provide you a product. It doesn't necessarily need a loyalty program to convince you to buy more shoes. Feel squeamish about all this personal information? Then my bet is you were born before 1982. Those born after, call them the millennials, echo boomers, the MySpace generation, don't. As consumers, they're going to change marketing. This is the Friends Talking Podcast. You're listening to Heavy Elements from Torley Wong. Listen to Torley's music on the Internet Archive. That's archive.org. This podcast is published under a non-commercial, attribution, share-alike, Creative Commons license. Burn this podcast to a CD, share it with your friends, pass it along. I'm Joel Greenberg. Thanks for listening.